Welcome to the Healing Grove Podcast. I'm Dr. Kristen Ryman, an integrative holistic family physician, author of Life After Lyme, and host in this virtual space of learning, healing, and growing. I believe humans are like trees, and our physical limb is only one of many. Health on all limbs of the tree, emotional, conceptual, social, spiritual, is absolutely required for the whole tree that is you to be vibrantly well. I created the Healing Grove Podcast as a place to showcase some of the world's best integrative and holistic medicine, to expose you to transformative tools and mindset shifts for all limbs of your tree. I hope you enjoy our conversation in the Healing Grove today as much as I enjoyed having it. So Ari Whitten, for those of you guys who don't know him, is a best-selling author and the creator of something called the Energy Blueprint System, which we're going to learn a little bit more about. He's a host of the extremely popular Energy Blueprint podcast, where he brings together amazing experts from all over the world, many of whom I really want to get in the Healing Grove at some point. But they're all experts on the subject of fatigue and energy optimization. Along with a Bachelor's of Science in Kinesiology, Ari has two advanced certifications from the National Academy of Sports Medicine and recently completed his coursework for a PhD in clinical psychology. So his education really rounds out all aspects of mind and body health in his approach to optimization. An energy and fatigue specialist, Ari is dedicated to bringing the cutting edge science of human energy enhancement to the world. And he's going to share with us some very cool techniques, both to gauge our own vitality really quickly, and also to increase it using something very, very simple that we all carry with us at all times, which I think I already spilled the beans in my email, but it's about breath work. So I'm really excited to have you here, Ari. Thank you so much. So before we get into your tool that you're going to share with us and technique, we always love to hear from our speakers sort of what brought you to this place in your own health journey. Like, how did you wind up being an energy and fatigue specialist?
There's a very long version or a short version of the story. I'll give you the super short version. I've been studying health science since I was a little kid. It's my lifelong passion. I've been a health geek ever since I was 12 or 13 years old, you know, kind of reading. I think I was reading college level nutrition and exercise physiology textbooks by the time I was 14 or 15. And from those early ages, it was typical teenage boy stuff. I was interested in, you know, biceps and abs and, you know, how to look good to get girls and that kind of thing. And I was always an athlete. I was always into body composition and eating well. And then things shifted for me a bit when I was in my mid-20s because I got mononucleosis from Epstein-Barr virus. And it was extremely severe for me. And I ended up being chronically fatigued for many, many months after that. And that really rocked my world. You know, being an athlete, always being healthy, always having high energy levels prior to that, it really shook me up and realized how much I took all of that for granted. And it gave me the empathetic perspective to realize how much your life suffers, everything in your life, your career, your schooling, your friends, your girlfriends, boyfriends, you know, every aspect of your life is almost taken away from you when you're chronically fatigued and you can't get out of bed. And that was a big catalyst for me to start to explore the science of energy levels. And I had already been studying health science and nutrition and fitness for more than a decade prior to that. So I had a strong background foundation already. But then I really delved into this energy and fatigue thing very deeply. And I very quickly discovered that there were sort of two camps of people that were dealing with that situation. And one was the conventional medical camp, and the short version, and I don't mean to be to sort of be attacking here, but the short version of conventional medicine in history in the treatment of chronic fatigue is they don't really have much to offer. They don't know what causes it. They don't really have any solutions for it. And I could tell you specifics of what their evidence-based guidelines of how to treat it are, if you're interested in exploring that in depth. And then the other side of it is kind of the natural health people. And those were the people that I always followed for many, many years. And in that community, they were all promoting the idea that energy levels, and if you're chronically fatigued, it's the result of something called adrenal fatigue, where you know, our adrenal glands produce this hormone called cortisol, which plays a role in the stress response and in releasing glucose from the cells to help regulate energy levels. And that with chronic stress, it sort of wears out the adrenal glands, then they can't produce enough cortisol, and then you get low energy levels as a result of that. And I was, you know, I read books on that, and, you know, the people who I idolized all promoted that idea, and I was pretty certain that was what's going on. But interestingly, as I it's kind of ironic actually how this happened, because I was really annoyed at conventional medicine for brushing off the whole theory of adrenal fatigue as nonsense. And I was convinced that it was true. So I kind of set out on a mission that I was going to prove the scientific reality of it. I was going to dig into all the scientific literature and prove that it's real and all these conventional doctors have it wrong. And when I started to dig into that literature, basically I found out that after about 6 months of, you know, full-time focus on that science, that research specifically, I pretty much found out that I was wrong, and that the overall body of evidence indicated that adrenal fatigue is not a valid way of conceptualizing why people are chronically fatigued. And the short version of it is that if you assess people with various kinds of chronic fatigue or stress-related exhaustion or chronic fatigue syndrome, and you measure their cortisol levels and adrenal function, and HPA axis function, hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis function, relative to normal healthy people. Basically, the vast majority of those studies find no detectable difference whatsoever and no clear pattern between.
Fascinating. Yeah. I have to stop at this moment because, you know, please, you and I both know there are still a lot of people in the sort of naturopathic and even, you know, the functional medicine world who are still talking about adrenal fatigue. So this is kind of like, just for those who don't know about this sort of like this controversy, like it's fascinating to hear someone who's almost like sort of like, you know, adrenal fatigue 2.0. Now we're talking about like the next iteration. So
that's right.
Yeah, that's really, so how was that for you to see like some of the people you'd been learning from sort of, you know, not be able to really stand, you know, couldn't really stand behind the science of them, what they were talking about?
That's an interesting question. I think it was almost, in a way, it was almost like a rite of passage and coming into my own as an expert myself. Meaning, you know, as you study this stuff, especially as a kid growing up, there's always this big gap between you as the student and the experts, you know, these authorities, these guys who have been out there doing it for a decade or two or three. And my perception was always, oh, they know 100-fold more than I'll ever know, you know. And then at a certain point, with enough obsessive study and enough, you know, thousands of hours and years of putting in the time and energy to study the science, you start to have these realizations of, oh, actually that person's wrong about this and this. And actually there's all this study, there's all this research that they're not even aware of. And I know that research and they don't. And so you start to discover more and more instances like that. And then you realize, oh, actually maybe I'm becoming somewhat of an expert now, you know? And, you know, I think in that way, it was kind of like a rite of passage for me. And I literally spent about a full year doing nothing but researching that question of adrenal fatigue. And I ended up putting out a huge analysis of many, many dozens of studies on that topic. Basically every study that's ever been done on the relationship of HPA axis function and fatigue, that's way more comprehensive than anyone has ever put forth. And I think I've actually been instrumental in helping to lead the natural health and functional medicine community a bit away from the adrenal fatigue hypothesis. I've gotten tons and tons of emails from other health practitioners who have been kind of blown away by that research and are like, hey, you know, I stopped promoting adrenal fatigue and diagnosing it because of what you shared. Basically, to wrap up the whole story, as I discovered that, That made me really interested in wanting to dig into what is the real science of what regulates human energy levels and how to optimize it. If it's not about just adrenals and cortisol function, what is it about and how do we optimize our energy levels? And that's really what I've been doing for the last almost decade now.
Amazing. So on behalf of everyone present, I just want to say good job for standing in your truth and for speaking that truth to power. This is a time in our lives when we all have to find our strength to kind of stand up to bullies, even when it's just over something as simple as, you know, where does energy deficiency come from? So I'm grateful for you. And really, I think I speak for everyone also when I say I'm really eager to know then where does the secret lie?
Well, it's a very complex answer. The short version is the human body is a very complex system. And it's always going to be wrong to single out, well, almost always going to be wrong to single out, you know, one specific system and one specific problem as, oh, that's the thing that's wrong. It's this one hormone, right? Or it's this one thing. It's too much inflammatory cytokines. Because the body is very much a web of interrelated physiological systems. And it's almost a non-thing that one physiological or biochemical abnormality would exist by itself in isolation. You know, the same is true for like autoimmune disease. If you say what causes autoimmune disease? Well, there's this complex web of genetic susceptibility sometimes and many, many different environmental influences that might lead to, let's say, excessive levels of inflammation and oxidative stress in the central nervous system that can then lead to the immune system attacking that and then can lead to multiple sclerosis, right? And it's not just, hey, inflammation is the cause. It would be wrong to say that because what caused the inflammation, right? So the same is really true with chronic fatigue. And if you were going to break it down so you can look at it at multiple layers, you can look at it, okay, what are the physiological mechanisms of what is mediating this fatigue? And then above that, what are some of the triggers or causes of those physiological mechanisms becoming dysfunctional? So in terms of the physiological mechanisms that are dysfunctional, the single most important one when it comes to fatigue is mitochondria. And we know now that mitochondria are not what we were all taught in our high school and college biology classes, that they're not just these sort of mindless energy generators, or as we were taught, the powerhouse of the cell. They are that. They are energy producing units of the cell. And most of the energy that our cells run on comes from mitochondria. However, what has been a novel discovery in the last 5 or 10 years is that mitochondria are not only that. They are not just these mindless energy generators that just take in, you know, carbs and fats and pump out energy. If that were the case, then having more energy levels would be as simple as just taking in more carbs and fats. So your mitochondria can produce more energy, but it doesn't work like that. The mitochondria don't just produce energy, they regulate. And what the key that's been discovered in the last 10 years or so, largely due to the work of a researcher named Dr. Robert Navio, who runs a lab for mitochondrial medicine at the University of California, San Diego. And what they've discovered is really that mitochondria have this second role beyond energy production that is about being essentially danger sensors or stress sensors. They are like the canaries in the coal mine, pretty much the most sensitive thing in our body. And Dr. Robert Amio calls it the hub of the wheel of our metabolism. And these mitochondria are essentially picking up on signals from the environment about whether the body is in a, what he terms peacetime metabolism or wartime metabolism. Okay. So in other words, whether the body is under attack or under threat or under stress, the mitochondria can sense that, or whether they're in a healthy, more optimal environment. But when they're under attack, when they sense the presence of stressors, and those stressors could be things like heavy metals or other environmental toxicants, endocrine disrupting chemicals. They can be poor nutrition and increased inflammatory cytokines as a result of all the different effects that eating, you know, processed crap has on the body. They can be alcohol consumption or cigarette smoke or breathing in, you know, volatile organic chemicals in the air. They can be psychological stress. There's a whole field called mitochondrial psychobiology with some brilliant researchers like Doug Wallace and Martine Picard, where they've done studies to show the effect of psychological stress on mitochondrial function, literally within seconds of the psychological stress occurring, and many other sources of stress. So poor gut health. There's a number of other layers. So breathing mechanics, light exposure, and many other different aspects of what's going on in the lifestyle and the environment, lack of sleep and circadian rhythm disruption, and so on. All of those things can be picked up and sensed by the mitochondria, where they essentially perceive these various kinds of stressors as an attack on the body. And what happens is mitochondria, again, they don't just produce energy, they regulate energy. They regulate how much energy should be produced. In other words, they decide whether cells should be in a mode where they're producing lots of energy, or if they're under attack, they shift out of energy mode into defense mode, or what Dr. Robert Nabiot calls the cell danger response, where resources are now directed, instead of into producing energy, they're directed into defending the body against the perceived threat. So in this model of understanding the human energy levels, we can essentially say that, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but it's largely accurate, to say that our energy levels, whether we're high energy bouncing off the walls like a little kid, I have two little kids, a five-year-old and a two-year-old running outside in my backyard right now, right outside these windows. And they're nonstop, right? Wanting to go all day, dad, can we do this? Can we do that? Can you take me for a bike ride? Can we do the slip and slide, you know? Or you're a person in poor health who's struggling with your energy levels, or that's the severe end of that spectrum, chronic fatigue syndrome, where you might be debilitated and have difficulty just walking across the room because your body's so shut down. So our energy levels in this model are essentially a reflection of the degree to which our mitochondria have shifted into defense mode as opposed to energy mode.
Wow. So like, and I understand that it's not just that simple, but it's such a helpful visual, I think, to just think about this kind of algorithm where you either take one path where you're vibrant and making energy for yourself to live a full life, or this other path where you're just basically like in lockdown, kind of like getting ready to fend off the zombies or whatever. So how do, I'm sure you're going to talk about, or you could talk about, all the different ways in which these different factors play in, like our thoughts and our fears and our emotions and other pieces of ourselves that don't start off as chemicals, but then translate into chemicals that the mitochondria can read. But I definitely want to get to breath. And I'm really curious about where that comes in terms of empowering the mitochondria to make that shift to vitality and then to support it there.
Yeah, great question. So one of the fundamental things that mitochondria need in order to produce abundant energy, they need really two things fundamentally. They need nutrients, largely in the form of carbs or fats, and they need oxygen. And that is fundamentally where breath comes into play, is what is the status of your body's delivery of oxygen to your cells, to your mitochondria? And one of the, there's many, many layers to that story that we can talk about, but one of the biggest ones is carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is thought by almost everybody to be just kind of a waste gas. You know, we breathe in oxygen, we breathe out carbon dioxide. And I've taken a lot of physiology courses in my life, and I've studied this for a long time. And it wasn't until maybe only 5 years ago that I first discovered the idea that carbon dioxide is playing a really critical role in our body, and that, you know, the way we breathe impacts that level of carbon dioxide and has an impact on us. It's always kind of taught in physiology courses like, oh yeah, carbon dioxide is kind of there, and it has a little bit of role in, you know, pH and things like that, but it's largely just a waste gas. It's a byproduct of your cells burning, using the oxygen and producing energy. And we just need to get rid of the carbon dioxide. Well, actually that's not true at all. We retain a lot of carbon dioxide as it's produced from our body. What is not happening is that we're breathing in oxygen, we're using all that oxygen, and then breathing out all the carbon dioxide. Our bodies are actually designed to retain a whole bunch of that carbon dioxide that's being produced. We don't expel it all. And what's really significant about that is the carbon dioxide plays a critical role in the ability of your blood cells, your red blood cells, to deliver oxygen to the cells. And this is something called the Bohr effect. It's B-O-H-R. And the way this works is that on each red blood cell, we have hemoglobin molecules. And those hemoglobin molecules carry oxygen molecules. And they, in order to carry them, they have to bind to them. So those red blood cells are floating around in our bloodstream, bound to that oxygen. Well, how does that oxygen disconnect from the hemoglobin, from the red blood cell? How does it disconnect from that red blood cell in our blood and then go into the cells that it needs to go into and into the mitochondria? Well, it has to disconnect. So what causes that disconnection? It is primarily the presence of carbon dioxide that causes that disconnection. And this is what the Bohr effect is. It's basically the main signal that actually disrupts the chemical bond between the oxygen molecules and the red blood cell is actually carbon dioxide. The presence of carbon dioxide causes that dissociation. And that's essentially, if you were to sort of anthropomorphize it, you could say it's like the carbon dioxide is yelling at the red blood cell, hey, I need oxygen, deliver it to me. You know, and so the presence of carbon dioxide is what's causing that oxygen to be delivered efficiently. And if you think about it like this, like just imagine that if you started doing squats right now, you started doing exercise or went for a run or went for a bike ride or something, all those leg muscles would be churning and using up a lot of oxygen and also producing a lot of carbon dioxide, because they're burning energy, and then one of the byproducts of burning energy and oxygen is producing carbon dioxide. So in the presence of that high amount of carbon dioxide, that cues the red blood cell to drop off oxygen to those tissues that are using up lots of oxygen and producing lots of carbon dioxide. Does that make sense? Okay, so from there, once you understand that basic principle that carbon dioxide is critical for oxygen delivery to the cells, there's a couple more layers that are important to understand here. One is that we have this idea that the way to better oxygenate our bodies is to do things like take deep breaths, like, you know, and if we take deep breaths, we're bringing in more oxygen and we're oxygenating our body. Actually, that's not true. Everybody already has more than enough oxygen on their red blood cells to deliver oxygen to their tissues. We actually carry a huge surplus of oxygen beyond what our cells need at any given time. And the oxygen saturation on red blood cells is between 95 to 100%, 99% at pretty much every given time that you're going to measure it. So the oxygen is there. The issue is not breathing in more oxygen. It's how do we get that oxygen to deliver to the cells efficiently? So, you know, telling somebody to take deep breaths is like the equivalent of telling somebody who's already eating enough food that they need to eat more food to get more energy. Doesn't work like that. So what's going on with this carbon dioxide picture? Well, what's happening is two things fundamentally. Chronic stress will cause, when you have stress, it stimulates an autonomic nervous system response. It stimulates your sympathetic or fight or flight nervous system to increase heart rate and increase breathing rate. So when people are chronically stressed, they start to have this chronic overstimulation of their breathing, and they start to breathe too much, essentially. In addition to that, through loss of fitness, when people are sedentary for long periods of time, when they don't exercise, the whole system becomes somewhat dysregulated in a way where you lose the proper matching of oxygen, taking in oxygen to carbon dioxide production. And you start to, because of the combination of those two things, your nervous system and your physiology essentially get wired into a state of chronic hypersensitivity to carbon dioxide and chronic overbreathing. So interestingly, what stimulates our desire to breathe is not a deficit of oxygen primarily, it's primarily the presence of carbon dioxide. So what happens in this state of chronic stress and decreased fitness is the body becomes essentially rewired into a state of chronic hypersensitivity to carbon dioxide and a chronic state of hyperventilation or overbreathing. So you're breathing in too much to constantly, as your body's constantly trying to offload and get rid of the perceived excess of carbon dioxide. Okay, so we've come, again, hypersensitive to the presence of carbon dioxide. So because of that, you lose carbon dioxide. Your carbon dioxide levels are chronically lowered. And what happens when you have low carbon dioxide is the oxygen now has difficulty dissociating from the hemoglobin and getting dropped off into your cells efficiently. So this is why what we see, for example, in people with chronic fatigue syndrome, when they do metabolic studies and look at mitochondria and energy production, they find that there's a huge proportion of anaerobic glycolysis happening, meaning the mitochondria are not taking in oxygen efficiently and producing energy in the way that they should be, in the efficient way. They're producing it through this anaerobic pathway that doesn't use oxygen and ends up producing a bunch of lactic acid. So people with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia have this excess production of lactic acid and inefficiency of using oxygen. And this is one of the fundamental reasons why is this dysfunctional breathing pattern. So let me take everyone through a quick practice here. It takes only about a minute to do this. And we'll gain some really good insight for it. So are you okay with me taking people through this quick little test?
Absolutely. Unless there's someone who shouldn't do it. Is there anyone who shouldn't do this little test?
No, I think that this one's pretty safe. It's not like an intense breathing practice or something like that. But if someone has, I'd say don't do it underwater, but we should be fine. And if someone is extremely frail and extremely poor health, you know, there's a risk of anything, but it's pretty safe. It should be fine. Great. So here's how you do it. We're going to take just a couple normal breaths, not deep breaths, just normal breaths. So take a couple deep breaths through your nose. And then on the breath after that, take a normal inhale, not an extra deep inhale, just a normal inhale, and then a normal exhale. Don't force out all your air, just a normal exhale. And at the end of it, hit your nose and we're going to hold. Okay. So do that as you're doing it, keep holding, and I'm going to count. So we're at maybe 5 seconds now, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40. Okay, you can release it now. Now, importantly, if you noticed that your breathing was strong after that, So like you had to take a deep breath to recover from it, as opposed to just a normal breath. That means you held too long, forced it a little bit too long. One thing I probably should have said is you should hold it only until your first urge to breathe. So if you did that, rather than holding to the, you know, your maximal breath hold capacity, this score for this, it's called the body oxygen level test. And it's developed by, you know, a whole methodology of breathing called Buteyko breathing, and a guy named Patrick McCown, who I've partnered with to produce a new breathing program called Breathing for Energy. He's one of the world's top breath experts. And this test essentially gives you insight into, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but it's kind of accurate to say that this is giving you insight into your body's overall energy and vitality score. Okay. And the reason I say that, it's also giving you insight into your body's sensitivity to carbon dioxide. So if you've been wired into dysfunctional breathing patterns, and if you got less than 20 or 25 seconds on this, that is an indication that your body has been wired into dysfunctional breathing patterns and you have a very high sensitivity to carbon dioxide. Okay, so the optimal length of time that a really healthy person should be able to do that is about 40 seconds. So that's why I stopped at about 40. Is if you made it past that, you did pretty good and you're in good shape. If you're sub 20 or sub 25, there's work to be done. The cool thing is that for each 5 second increase in this, you're going to notice a significant difference in your energy levels. You're going to notice improvements for each 5 seconds that you improve your BOLT score. So this is a great objective test to assess your body's overall fitness, vitality, and sensitivity to carbon dioxide that you can measure very simply in less than 1 minute every day and really track your progress. The reason I say it's a great test for your overall sort of energy and vitality is because we have pretty much no other test that is good for assessing energy and vitality. There is no blood test. There is no particular blood test marker or hormonal test or anything like that that you can look at and say, hey, that's a great reflection of your energy levels. This test, and I should also mention, there's research looking at standard blood tests in people with chronic fatigue, and 95% of people with chronic fatigue who go to get their blood tested have perfectly normal blood test results. There is nothing on those blood tests that can explain their chronic fatigue in 95 out of 100 cases. So most blood testing, in other words, is not a great measure to give you insight into your energy levels. This test, believe it or not, this simple little thing that anyone can do without any fancy equipment, I found is by far the most effective way to assess your body's level of energy and vitality. And it actually predictably correlates with energy and vitality, unlike almost every other test that you could do.
Wow. So, amazing. Especially for people with chronic fatigue who often look like kind of the living dead, right? They feel awful, but they mm-hmm. look normal and their labs look normal. Right. So it's amazing to have something this simple that's replicable that I can use moving forward. So thank you for teaching us that. I'm desperate to know, is there as simple a tool to fix the problem, Ari? Like, because now everyone but two people on this call are like, okay, tell me what to do next, because right. I was definitely under 40.
Yes. So, and by the way, even quite a number of athletes can be under 40. So you'd be surprised, even some fit people will score under 40. I think I was under 40 when I first did this test years ago before I started doing breathwork practices. Maybe I was 30 or something like that. So there's three fundamental things that you need to do in order to reset that CO2 sensitivity. One is that you need to decrease your body's, number one is that you need to stop over breathing and chronically getting rid of too much carbon dioxide, okay? Because your body has become wired into a state where it's it's got that decreased carbon dioxide sensitivity, and it's been wired into that overbreathing hypersensitivity to carbon dioxide. So how do we adjust that? Well, there's a few keys to optimizing our normal breathing habits in order to start to correct that and training our body to be a bit less sensitive to carbon dioxide. So one of those things is that we want to have nasal breathing. Nasal breathing as opposed to mouth breathing is incredibly important. And nasal breathing does a few things for us. One, it helps us produce another gas called nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is another gas that's been widely sort of misunderstood for many years. It's only recently that we've really had a good understanding of it. But nitric oxide plays a critical role in blood vessel dilation. So to give you an idea of how profound of an impact this has, there was a study done a few years ago on nasal polyposis, where they looked at men who had nasal polyps that inhibited their ability to breathe through their nose. And they found this huge correlation between nasal polyps and erectile dysfunction. They had difficulty getting and maintaining an erection because of difficulty breathing through their nose. They did a surgery to remove the nasal polyps so they could breathe through their nose, and all of a sudden, the erectile dysfunction went away. Why? The answer is because when we breathe through our nose as opposed to our mouth, it produces much, much greater amounts of this gas called nitric oxide that plays a critical role in dilating our blood vessels and allowing for much better circulation and delivery of blood and oxygen to the tissues. So, that's how profound of an impact it is, of a difference it is to breathe through the nose or the mouth. So we want nose breathing. We want diaphragmatic breathing. We want to engage our belly and not just our chest. And we know that that's also going to increase oxygen utilization. And we also want slow breathing and light breathing. Okay, so there's, again, this big myth around optimal breathing is like, you know, this myth has been perpetuated for many, many years that we're supposed to be taking these huge deep breaths, and that's what's going to lead to good oxygenation of the tissues. In fact, it does not do that. That just offloads even more carbon dioxide, and deep intense breathing actually causes sympathetic nervous system activation, and it mimics a stress response. You can think of it like this. How do you breathe when you're doing exercise or running away from a lion, right? You're breathing like really deep, big, you know, fast breaths. Okay. The opposite of that, in a state of very deep relaxation, it's almost imperceptible breathing. Like if you watch a baby sleeping, it's sometimes hard to even, you know, see their belly move. It's so slow, it's so small, it's so light and gentle that it's almost imperceptible. That is actually the breathing that we're striving for. So one of the things that we can work on is just put two fingers beneath your nose, close your mouth, put two fingers beneath your nose, not plugging it, but just a little with a little space there. And now just try to take some normal breaths and notice the airflow coming out of your nose onto your fingers. Just notice that sensation for a few breaths. And now keep doing it and try to now take in half as much air and to do it twice as slowly. So super slow inhale and exhale, make it as slow as possible, and don't take in deep breaths, still take in little more sips of air slowly, but take in half as much air and expel half as much air. Take a few more breaths like that. And you should try to strive for almost not even being able to feel the airflow on your fingers beneath your nose, okay? And a few breaths in, maybe you're starting to feel a little bit of air hunger and it feels difficulty, like you wanna take a deep breath. And that is actually the carbon dioxide building up and that sensitivity, your brain going, oh, carbon dioxide levels are rising, you need to take a deep breath. Okay. So this simple little practice of intentionally, and you can take your hand down from your nose, just doing that for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, two or three times a day can start to train the body, just like exercise trains the body. You work a muscle and it gets stronger. This is training the body to learn how to tolerate little bits of air hunger that's created through increased carbon dioxide levels. So it's training the body to be able to tolerate higher levels of carbon dioxide. Interestingly, that increased level of carbon dioxide also correlates with anxiety. And maybe you noticed it. Maybe you noticed as the carbon dioxide levels rose, it wasn't just a desire to breathe. It's, whoa, I'm feeling like stressed. I'm feeling uncomfortable, right? So when we have when we have a very high sensitivity to carbon dioxide, and even relatively low levels of it trigger air hunger and stress, that is part of what wires us into chronic stress mode. Carbon dioxide itself can create stress. So what do we do to fix that? Well, one thing is correct normal breathing patterns so that we're nasal breathing, we're doing light breathing, we're doing slow breathing and diaphragmatic breathing. So we're trying to train in a new pattern of how to breathe to mimic that baby, right? With the almost super slow, gentle, imperceptible breath. That's what we're striving for as our normal breathing pattern. From there, one of the other big things that we can do is we can do what's called intermittent hypoxic training, which is essentially breath holding practices. And through a much more aggressive than what I just showed you is very gentle. Through a much more aggressive breath holding practice, and this is the one that I would say is, you know, only appropriate for people of decent health already. For people who are not in decent health, it's much better to spend a few weeks sticking with basic practices like the one I just showed you, done for a few minutes, a few times a day, and that will absolutely be enough to start resetting that threshold. If you're already in decent health, you can start to work on some of these breath hold practices. And there's a few different varieties of how to do them. Some of them have been popularized by Wim Hof. And there's also, you know, things called alkaline breathing or DMT breathing, which are sort of variations on the general theme of it. But basically, part of the practice is to do very deep inhales, full, fast inhales, and then only partial exhales that are not forced, but just relaxing and letting the air naturally flow out, not fully, but partially. And then another big inhale done for 30 to 50 times. And then after that, after flooding the body with oxygen and also clearing out tons of carbon dioxide, then you hold your breath in that state. You fully exhale and hold on the exhale and you hold your breath. And in that state, you'll find that you can hold your breath much longer than normal. And through this kind of training, it is essentially like advanced, you know, elite level exercise training for resetting the brain's sensitivity to carbon dioxide. And through doing that, you can completely change your carbon dioxide threshold, which can change your normal breathing patterns, and can your body will then learn to produce optimal levels. It'll stop overbreathing and you'll produce optimal levels of carbon dioxide that will help facilitate oxygen delivery to those cells. Okay. So anybody in poor health, I'd recommend not doing this practice, but anybody who wants to do it, we can do a brief version of it together right now. And I won't take you through a very aggressive version of it, but we'll do a sort of gentler version of it. In the program that I've developed with Patrick McCown, we've created 6 progressive levels of this. So starting from level 1, which is, you know, it's maybe 5 to 15 second breath holds, all the way up to multi-minute breath holds at the more advanced levels. So there's guided practices that kind of take you through that. And so each week as you're progressing, you can go to the next level. But here's a fairly basic practice that might be the equivalent of level one or level two. So the first thing we'll do it through the nose. This is more called alkaline breathing. So we're going to do a full inhale through the nose and then an exhale through the mouth. Again, the inhale should be absolutely intense and powerful. And as full as you possibly can, you want to fill your belly, fill your lungs as much as you can. And then you're just going to release it about halfway. So you're not going to force exhale and go and breathe it all out. You're going to go full inhale. And then you're just going to relax. And then another inhale. And then a relax. So do it with me. Five more. Last one, and then we're going to force exhale out all the air. Everything out and hold and close your nose. And we're going to hold here. So I think that was maybe 40 seconds or so, maybe 50 seconds to give you an idea. And that practice, and after do that, that's just one round of it. Typically you do three or five or sometimes even more rounds of that. And it turns into a, something like a 10 to 20 minute practice. But that simple practice done progressively, done where you really do it as a dedicated practice every day, and you build that up over weeks. So you go from the point where you're holding 20 or 30 or 40 seconds to the point where you can do a 2 to 3 or longer minute breath hold. That practice and working on that, I found is literally, and this is not an exaggeration, I found that's literally the single fastest and most powerful way to increase a person's energy levels. Very, very rapidly. And you can make a huge difference just through that one simple practice that takes 10 minutes a day. And it works so powerfully because, well, it's doing a whole bunch of things. One, it's resetting that CO2 threshold. And that's allowing your normal breathing pattern to start to reset. Okay, so done in tandem with those previous principles I talked about, those four principles of optimal breathing, nasal breathing, light, slow, and diaphragm breathing. If you work on training that as your baseline breathing pattern, and then you also engage this to reset your CO2 threshold, those two things in tandem basically are like a reset for now allowing your breathing rate to change and your breathing pattern to change and your CO2 levels to rise without the hypersensitivity and the anxiety that comes from that, but actually lowering your baseline levels of anxiety and the CO2 levels, the higher CO2, now allows for much more efficient oxygen delivery to your cells. So you can take people who are, you know, in this anaerobic metabolism where their cells are not able to use oxygen efficiently because of their breathing, their dysfunctional breathing pattern. And now you can start to get that oxygen into those cells where it can be, where it can facilitate mitochondrial energy production. Now, in addition to all that, this is also a powerful type of hormesis. And hormesis is my favorite topic. I can talk to you about it for 2 or 3 hours. But the gist of it, it is that it's a temporary metabolic stressor that stimulates the body to make adaptations that ultimately confer higher levels of stress resistance. Okay, so this actually creates some oxidative stress. It's creating metabolic stress temporarily when you do it. Just like exercise is a stressor on the system. But because it temporarily stresses the system, and you don't want to be in a chronic state of stress, but to temporarily stress the body through things like exercise or breath holding practices, you're creating pressure on that system to adapt to that stress. And those adaptations make you stronger and give you more energy. And the specific adaptations that occur through these types of intermittent hypoxic training, these breath holding practices, are there's a bunch of different layers of it, but one, it increases lung capacity. Two, it actually creates a little bit of micro trauma to the interface between the lungs, between the alveoli, the little sacs of air in the lungs, and the capillaries around them. And it reshapes that surface. So in a similar way to, you know, how lifting a weight creates micro trauma to the muscle that causes it to be rebuilt bigger and stronger, this creates micro trauma between the surfaces of the lung air sacs and the blood capillaries that run there, so that they learn to be able to extract oxygen from the lungs more efficiently and to offload carbon dioxide when it's needed. In addition to that, you get the same kind of structural changes at the surface between the capillaries and cells, so that it also learns to deliver oxygen to the cells more efficiently, right? Because by breath holding, by doing these breath holding practices, your cells are basically getting the signal, we don't have enough oxygen. So the body makes adaptations to be able to deliver more oxygen to those tissues in the same way that being at altitude does that. In addition to that, speaking of altitude, one of the things that altitude does is, because oxygen levels of the blood drop, the body goes, hey, we need more oxygen carrying capacity. So it releases a hormone called EPO that actually leads to the production of more red blood cells to increase oxygen carrying capacity. Well, it turns out that these practices, this intermittent hypoxic training, can actually stimulate the same thing. So you can actually increase your red blood cells and increase your oxygen carrying capacity at the same time. So in addition to that, one more layer, and there's probably five more layers we could talk about, but one more layer is actually, there are changes at the mitochondria level itself, where the mitochondria get bigger and stronger and learn to extract and utilize oxygen more efficiently and produce energy more efficiently. So all of those changes are occurring from these simple, you know, few minute long, 10 minute long breath hold practices that you can do every day. And because of that, you can literally rewire your normal breathing patterns and your brain sensitivity to carbon dioxide, which allows for oxygen delivery to the cells, which helps take you out of, you know, that chronic anaerobic inefficient energy production mode, and creates all these different structural changes and increases oxygen carrying capacity of your blood, so that you can hold and deliver oxygen to your cells way more efficiently.
Amazing. Amazing. I'm just blown away by your ability to teach this really complex stuff so simply and clearly. I just can't thank you enough. Thank you so much. So much.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Kristen. I really appreciate it.
All right. Be well, everyone. Breathe slowly like a baby.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Healing Grove podcast. If you liked it, please be sure to like and subscribe. And if you want to deepen your experience further, consider grabbing a copy of the Healing Grove Playbook. With journal prompts for this podcast and 41 others, it's the perfect place to record your learnings, keep track of the tools you explore, and reflect on your own experience. Finally, it's important to mention that even though I am a doctor, nothing you hear on this podcast, whether from myself or my guests, constitutes medical advice. Any intervention you try should always be discussed with and supervised by a trusted member of your own healing team. Thanks for listening, and see you next time in the Healing Grove.